You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
So welcome everyone to the launch of Transforming Health, International Rights-Based Advocacy for Trans Health Report. We're very glad that you could all join us tonight. We have what we hope is a very interactive panel featuring a number of case studies on the report. We have the author of the report, and also we have a trans health specialist based here in New York who will also talk about some interesting research that's been done with local trans communities. So my name is Dave Scammell. I'm a program officer at the Open Society Foundations. I work as part of the public health program. And specifically, I work with the Sexual Health and Rights Project and the Law and Health Initiative, which are two parts of Open Society Foundation. This is a report which was put out by the Sexual Health and Rights Project. For those of you who may not be so familiar with Open Society Foundations, we are a private foundation which is committed to supporting civil society engagement around a range of issues furthering human rights and democracy. The public health program is a health and human rights rather than a sort of a strict public health. We're a health and human rights funder, and we fund it on a range of issues, including the supporting the health and human rights advocacy for trans communities around the world. So in terms of today's panel, we have four speakers, including Kellen Baker, who is a consultant to Open Society Foundations and also the author of the report. We have Lisa Theron, who is the Executive Director of Gender Dynamics. We have Adrian Lawyer, who is the Director of the Transgender Resource Centre for New Mexico. And we also have Anita Ruddix, MD, who is the Senior Director of Research and Education at Callan Lord Community Health Centre here in New York. So without any further ado, I will hand it over to Kellen Baker. So Kellen is, as I said, a consultant with OSF. He authored the report, Transforming Health. He's also a health policy analyst with the Centre for American Progress based in Washington, D.C., where he works on LGBT health issues at the federal and state levels. Kellen holds a BA with high honours from Swarthmore College and an MPH in Global Health Policy and an MA in International Development from George Washington University.
Thanks, Dave, and thanks to all of you for coming out. Can everybody hear me? I'm not quite sure. My degree is actually in astrophysics, but I can't work technology, so I always need to check and make sure that I've done it correctly. Okay, excellent. So as Dave said, my name is Kellen, and I was the author of this report, Transforming Health, Rights-Based Strategies for Advancing Transgender Health. And I'm going to talk just briefly about where the report came from, what some of the methodology looked like, and what some of the results look like before we turn it over to Liesl and the other folks here on the panel to talk through some of the specific work that some of the organizations profiled in the report are doing, and then down to Dr. Ruddix to talk about some brand new research. So this report was the outcome of a lot of thinking about what does it mean to recognize what transgender health actually is. Because I feel like, and this is something that we hear a lot, is that transgender health is something that not a lot of people feel like they understand. It is something to do with surgery. It is something to do with, I don't really know. It is something to do with people that I may not feel I understand, and people that may not actually receive the care that they need in facilities from doctors, from providers who treat them like human beings. Because as we know, in the words of Susan Stryker, people frequently have difficulty recognizing the humanity of another human being if they cannot tell that person's gender. And as a result, transgender people around the world, including here in the United States, experience extreme prejudice, harassment, and violence. Transgender, as many of you likely know, is a popular umbrella term talking about the experience of people whose gender identity, their internal sense of themselves as male, female, or something else, does not exactly align with the sex that they were assigned at birth. Trans is a general umbrella term. A lot of people claim that identity for themselves, while other people are identified as transgender on the basis, or as we like to use, trans, on the basis of society's expectations of how men and women are supposed to act. Transgender people, like anybody else, come from a wide variety of backgrounds. We are of all sexual orientations. We live in all kinds of places, in all countries. We are all races, all religions. But one of the things that unites trans people is that experience of discrimination. Because no matter who we are, we're frequently confronted with institutional, not just individual, but institutional discrimination in areas like housing, employment, education, relationship recognition, recognition in our true gender, and in healthcare, which is a particularly cruel reality because many transgender people need specific healthcare services to fully express their true gender. And not only that, but a lot of this discrimination is compounded by other social forces like racism, like sexism, like poverty, that make it hard for all of us, in many cases, to navigate the world and to get the services that we need. So this report talks about what trans people are doing to fight back against all of the forces that tell us that we don't have the right to be who we are, that we don't have the right to get the healthcare that we need. The report was put out, or the call for proposals was put out in the spring of 2011, and we received approximately 20 proposals or case study submissions from around the globe. The proposal was made available in 6 different languages, and it was disseminated online because that was the way that we figured we would be able to hit the broadest range of folks who are doing work specifically that draws on human rights-based strategies to frame the issues that transgender people are facing and to talk about how to advance transgender health. And importantly, and this is a topic I'm going to return to when I discuss the findings of the report in a little bit more detail, this report, when we talk about trans health, it's not just about transition-related services. It's not just about the services that trans people may need to fully express their gender identity. It's talking about what the World Health Organization defines as a complete sense of mental, physical, and emotional health, and all of the services that we need, any of us need, to make sure that we're able to lead full and healthy lives. So the report, ultimately, and you can see there's lovely copies over there. Please pick them up. We're very excited that they're printed and available for today. The report showcases the work of 16 different organizations from almost a dozen different countries, as well as the World Health Organization. The organizations that submitted case studies, which you can see in the report, they're along the bottom of the pages here. These are the actual case studies themselves, while the text above them talks about some of the findings, some of the patterns that we identified. The contributors were Red Trans Nicaragua, Shusta Jivon from Bangladesh, Planned Parenthood here in the United States, Transgender Law Center, Center of Excellence for Transgender Health, Transgender Resource Center of New Mexico, St. James Infirmary and the Gender Health Center, all from the United States, Mither Trust, run by a nurse practitioner here in New York, the Gay, Bi, Queer, Trans Men's Working Group from Canada, Transgaten from Serbia, GenderDoc M from Moldova, Kyrgyz Labrys from Kyrgyzstan, Gender Dynamics again from South Africa, Stop Trans Pathologization 2012, and again the World Health Organization. And there will be a quiz after this, so any of you who have forgotten even one of those countries, you're done for. Not sure. So I don't want to spend too much time on the findings of the report itself because you have copies that you can pick up and read, and we have some folks here to talk about specifically the work that they've done. But I just want to highlight some of the patterns or the trends that we identified in the work that's being done by these 16 different organizations. One of those trends is, as I discussed previously, providing healthcare services that aren't related to transition. So including preventive and primary care, sexual and reproductive health services, and mental and behavioral health services. And then, of course, providing healthcare services that are related to transition, including hormone therapy, mental health services, and reconstructive surgeries. And we should emphasize that these services may be different for individual people. There's no one set way to transition, but there is this common thread of various services that transgender people may need in order to transition. Cultural competency of healthcare providers was another major issue, making sure that they have the training to respect and respond to the health needs of trans people. Conducting public education that's aimed at raising awareness of trans experiences and the discrimination that trans people face. Pursuing community-based research projects in collaboration, and this is a key point, with trans communities themselves, so that we know where the data, not only where it's coming from, but where it's going to be used. Organizing and mobilizing, getting trans communities and their allies out and organizing in order to advance healthcare and human rights for trans people. And advocating for policy change. This is near and dear to my heart as somebody from Washington, D.C., a policy wonk. But policy change aimed at reforming the legal, medical, and other systems that impact transgender people's lives, including the policies regarding gender markers on identity documents, which underlie so many of the opportunities that trans people do or frequently do not have to participate in the activities of everyday life. So the report makes numerous recommendations to governments, to human rights advocates, to trans communities and health professionals, as well as to the World Health Organization and the American Psychiatric Association, which maintains the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is one of the main places that trans healthcare is organized here in the United States under the diagnosis in the DSM, as well as to funders, to those of us who are able to move resources, to move attention, to pay attention to what are the specific needs of trans people and how can we address them. And with that, I will turn it over to Liesl Theron to talk about her work with gender dynamics. And we're happy to take any questions about the report or any of the presentations at the end.
Good evening. Can you hear me well? I think I will just start with a very brief background of gender dynamics. I think some of it is also written in the report. Gender Dynamics started being an organization since 2005. It was the first time for South Africa or Africa to have an organization addressing the needs of transgender people. So initially, the work of Gender Dynamics started out just collecting data of transgender people who transition, that we could collect the data and people could go on with the rest of their life if that was the idea, because there was no other way for them to pass on information to the next person and the next person. So everyone always had to start reinventing the wheel from the beginning. The whole transition means everything have to be researched from the start. So moving from 2005 with that background and very limited resources, very limited information about where people can find each other, to a space where we now in 2013 organization that is not the only one in South Africa, there's two others, and there's also on the rest of the continent more transgender organizations. So a lot of things changed in the last few years in South Africa and in Africa. What makes South Africa's system regarding medical access and healthcare quite unique is the fact that we have a dual system. We have what we call Western medicine, and many people access their healthcare that way. And then we also have a traditional healthcare system. And according to the WHO and the study they did previously, basically 80% of people in Africa access health through traditional healthcare and traditional healers, herbal healers, and alternative ways. In other words, not Western medicine. So it is very important that we start looking also in accessing different type of collaborations regarding making things available for transgender people. Then when one look at the Western medicine side of things in South Africa, obviously there's private healthcare and public healthcare. So really it's almost as if there's three systems. Then in 2010, Genodynamics had a small conference, basically just with people from South Africa. I think we were about 50 people. And we just started for a weekend long having a brainstorm, what is the needs that people needed to start being addressed by an organization, but also on different other levels. And then in November 2011, we had a larger conference. And we were basically 120 people. There was a good mixture between transgender people and medical service providers, because obviously now over a few years, we started building up networks with different medical practitioners who then obviously could attend the conference, including we had Sangomas, that is the name for people that are traditional health providers. It was quite a vibrant conference, and we had a lot of different streams of workshops. Most of it was being done in plenary, that there's not really a big division in some people only access certain types of information, but that we could actually really have a lot of sharing. Anita was there, James was there, there was quite a other few people that's in this room, Dave were there as well. So it was quite a vibrant space, and I think we would obviously from there move on to in the future try and see to have that type of conferences again. So that is just kind of like a background in this, but I think also regarding the other work of Genodynamics that we are doing is many times accessing local clinics. A number of our people access even primary health care through a nurse or a sister at the clinic. So there's a lot of challenges actually to get people educated and to understand what things are about. Many times the assumption is that there will be prejudice and or not enough resources. And the more you start working with a person one-on-one or them being exposed to information directly from either a transgender client or patient or organization like Genodynamics, you can start seeing the change in their attitude and their willingness to work. So it really becomes a situation of you need many feet or many hands and people out there to do, even on an individual basis, the advocacy. So we have quite a dynamic system in the country. I think what I just want to end with, because it's always easier that people ask questions but is not clear to them, because in 10 minutes you cannot really cover the whole dynamic of one country, let alone the rest of the continent at all. So during the conference, we had different streams, like there was research, there was HIV, we had a whole half day spent just with parents and the topic of youth and that type. So we really had a lot of different streams. So some of the recommendations that came out from the conference that time was, for example, that gender-affirming therapies like hormones should be decentralized from tertiary institutions rather into local clinics, because it will be much more accessible for people then to, in a very close range from where they are staying, get access. South Africa have basically a 30% of unemployment. So it is, even if you have willing people to help you, even if that was ideal, people cannot get service. As we all know, you cannot just by a one visit receive hormones or just receive whatever step it is that you want to have. So it becomes very costly for a person to actually access, even on a very basic level, the needs that I have. Then also what we realize is that the nurses make up the majority of the health personnel in South Africa and are responsible for delivering primary health care. So again, another recommendation is to ensure that the network between whatever advocacy in the medical way we have is also with the nurses' union and through the channels that I have of distributing information, because actually a huge amount of people will then be helped or at least get some service in that way. Then also these intersections between the stigma that transgender people face and issues such as rape and sexual violence, sex work, homelessness, unemployment, and the vulnerability to HIV infection, and need to further explore and be addressed. So again, linkages, for example, with other organizations that is either HIV focused, or there's a very large sex worker organization based in Cape Town, to in other words, work with them. Then South Africans need to start also embark on more production of knowledge and have actually authentic research. So I think this is where I'm gonna leave it for now, because I'm much more open that we have a conversation and questions. It will be easier that way.
Great, so next, thanks, Liesl. Next I want to introduce Adrian Lawyer. And Adrian is the Executive Director of the Transgender Resource Center of New Mexico. He's a longtime activist and advocate in the LGBTQ communities. He's proud to be focusing his efforts on transgender folks, along with their families and loved ones. The Transgender Resource Center of New Mexico is working in many areas to improve the lives of trans people in the state of New Mexico, including but not limited to education, advocacy, information and referrals, HIV prevention, harm reduction, homelessness, and youth issues. The Resource Centre partners with many varied organisations on these efforts and has sent its Speakers Bureau, which is going to be the focus of Adrian's talk, into over 40 different settings to educate on transgender issues and lives. He is the father of a young son and has been with his partner for over 12 years. He's also a trans man.
Thanks, Dave.
Yep.
And thanks to OSF for having us here. It's really, this report is so exciting. Kellen did a wonderful job and all of the submissions were so inspiring. Getting to go and be in San Francisco with everybody back in 2011 was something that really actually set a lot of the direction for the work that we're doing now. I do want to talk about our Speakers Bureau, but I also want to tell y'all what we are doing now, because things have changed so much since the fall of 11 when we all convened. So to begin, our Speakers Bureau is just what it sounds like. I actually was doing some... I was going out with the Speakers Bureau of our local PFLAG in Albuquerque as sort of the trans representative on panels that were filled with all different types of LGBT folks and also their family members. And we would get out there and everybody would have 5 or 7 minutes to sort of tell their story. And at the end, it would be Q&A. And there were, you know, 3 hours worth of questions just for me. So, you know, at that point, we realized there was a really strong need to do just transgender cultural competency education. And so we put together our Speakers Bureau, which now has over 60 volunteers that span every possible category and identity. And also, again, many partners and parents and children of trans people who really enrich these educational experiences, I think, for the audience to be able to talk to folks who are cisgender, but who are intimately involved and engaged with a transgender person, can sometimes bridge a gap there, you know, when you're trying to get this information out. So we go out and we have a PowerPoint. I know people go, oh, PowerPoint, but our PowerPoint's really exciting and really funny and really great. And so it's called Transgender 101. And usually I'm the one who delivers that 101 presentation. And then we have 3 to 5 people who come and just share about their personal lives, their experiences. And then we usually engage in very candid Q&A at that time. So we've been doing that since 2008 or 2009 in New Mexico, and now we've ended up doing it all around the country, in addition to all around the state of New Mexico. Probably more than 150 times now we've taken this presentation out. And in all of those times, you know, I have to struggle to think of 1 or 2 times where we got any type of pushback or negative feedback from an audience member or from an audience. Generally, people are so excited and so grateful to get this information and to have some of this stuff demystified that it just really encourages us to keep going and keep going. So initially, our target audiences for this were clinicians. So, you know, obviously nurses and doctors, and we especially love to get them when they're still in school and they know that they still have things to learn. So we love to talk to students of any type of clinical practice, but we also talk to mental health therapists. We talk to, you know, occupational therapists, physical therapists, almost anyone we can get our hands on who would interact with a patient in a clinical setting. So we have found that this has really helped to break down some barriers for trans people trying to access healthcare, which the latest statistic that I've heard is a disheartening 3 out of 4 trans people don't want to enter a clinician's office of any type because of the types of hostilities and abuses that we faced in those settings. We just don't even want to go in. So doing this education and being able to provide information about where there are culturally competent providers is helping people start to engage with primary care in our communities, some for the first time. We have a doc who does a wonderful job of providing hormone replacement on an informed consent basis. So people are going down there to see him and coming back and saying, oh, I loved Dr. Andrew so much that now I have a doctor. And they wouldn't have said that before. So we really feel that education is doing a lot of good in our region. So in 2011, when we met for the first time and submitted these papers, we did not yet have our first location. And in February of last year, we moved into our first drop-in center in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And since that time, the work that we've done around health really directly, and also then work on lots of cofactors around health, has just, you know, increased exponentially. So one of our primary funding streams right now is HIV prevention through our health department in New Mexico, with whom we have a really strong, vibrant partnering relationship. So of course we do HIV testing and prevention interventions. We're doing harm reduction services, so we're one of the only syringe exchange sites in New Mexico that exchanges for injection drug use, but also exchanges the larger syringes that are needed for intramuscular injection for hormone usage. So it's a really exciting thing to know that we are able to help our community members, regardless of what type of syringe they need. We're getting clean syringes, new syringes out to people for whatever they need them for. We are doing really formalized and informal suicide prevention work. I'm sure a lot of people in here are already familiar with Injustice at Every Turn, the really groundbreaking study that was authored in 2011 that showed us that our suicide attempt rate is reported at 41% versus a 1.6% rate for the general population. So learning suicide prevention methodologies is a really big part of what we're trying to do, just to help to keep our folks alive out there. We are also bringing in a doctor. In fact, I think it may be the doc from Planned Parenthood who's part of this amazing publication, to do a clinical training for other doctors in New Mexico on hormone replacement therapy. We now know it's something that's been shown over and over again, including in the really wonderful documentary called Transgender Tuesdays, that when people have access to hormone replacement, they are way more likely to go ahead and continue with primary care in that clinical setting. So we want to have a lot of our low-income clinics in New Mexico provide and be capable of providing hormone replacement, because we know that's going to cause people to be able to get actual health care. We're still doing our speakers bureau. That's just going strong. But now we've expanded that to target employers as well as clinicians, because we're really trying to work on economic development as a huge priority in New Mexico. We're training our community members on job-seeking skills, but we know we have to go out there and train the employers too, not just on cultural competency, but also, why are transgender people terrific employees? Why would you want to hire a transgender employee? We're trying to get that message out. We never set out to be a clinic. We know we couldn't possibly handle the volume in even Albuquerque, much less New Mexico. So we're trying to do a lot of training of other clinics, but we did pilot 2 health clinics in our space last fall, because we knew that our communities might come and access some preventive screenings if it was offered in a place where they already know that they're safe, which is our drop-in center, where people already are hanging out and convening. So we did a PAP clinic for trans men. And then in the same month, in September of last year, we did an STI testing clinic that we called a Transgender Wellness Night, and we tried to offer a lot of information and incentives and did a ton of testing with one of our local health department clinics. And we had 80 people show up for that, over 30 people who received some type of testing, and a 30% positive rate on that STI testing. So we know then that people were able to get treatment for an STI that they may not have even known that they had. We partnered with a local surgeon in Albuquerque to offer a scholarship. He's agreed to do a $2,500 a year for the next 3 years scholarship on chest surgery for either trans male or trans female patients. So we're just getting ready to roll out the application process for that. We have a doctoral student at UNM who is wanting to do their dissertation with us, and it's going to be a health needs assessment of our community using like photo documentation that the individual people are gonna do themselves. We're gonna give them cameras and train them on some different photography skills, and then have them go out and compile these sort of self-documented films as a needs assessment. It's something we're really excited about. Also in the publication, I know the Center of Excellence submitted their paper on the CATCH model, which is coalition building in communities, and right now there are 3 states that have a CATCH coalition building, and we're one of them, so we're really actively involved in building that CATCH coalition. In fact, we'd like for that coalition to end up being our sort of community planning group. So we're trying to bring together and build community among all types of trans people all over the state, and then what we want is for them to tell us what we need to do, right? As an agency, let the community steer the direction and the priority of the work that we're doing for trans folks in our state. We are partnering with so many people, and one of the amazing things we're doing with the University of New Mexico's Queer Resource Center is an LGBT 101 class for the UNM University of New Mexico hospital staff. So this is right now a self-selecting group, but we've already done it 4 or 5 times where we come in and do a 4-hour LGBT 101, and this is for anyone of the like 6,000 employees in that hospital system. So we're seeing everybody from, receptionists to aides to nurses to doctors in that class and getting information out that way. We're also offering AccuDetox, which is an ear acupuncture that's recommended for any kind of quitting or cutting down on substances of any kind, but also is really just a good thing for relaxation as well. We have a community partner who's coming in and doing that at no charge for our folks. And we're getting ready to start engaging in what's called ECHO, which is telehealth in New Mexico, whereby you are able to talk to doctors and clinical people in all parts of the state at one time via, basically like a Skype type of an application. At our drop-in center, we have a closet, so we just have clothing that people can take. We also try to keep binders, wigs, bras, all types of sort of trans items that can be a little bit expensive and sometimes sort of embarrassing or hard to go and shop for. We have those things donated so that people can take them at no cost. We have food, which sounds like a small thing but is a huge thing. We have just food that people can come in and eat. We have a television, we have games and books and make a community space where people want to be. And a lot of our people are wrestling with homelessness, either chronically or acutely, and our drop-in center is the place where they can come in and get out of the weather and have some food and be with other people in a place that they know they're safe. If they need to just take a nap on the couch, it's a safe place that you can do that. Your backpack is not going to get taken and run away down the street. We have 8 different support groups that meet at different intervals all through the month. And Liesl and I were talking, one of the ones we're really proud of is a partners group that meets once a month on a social basis. That's the only thing that we do where transgender people are actually not allowed to participate, because we feel that cisgender partners are such a big part of our community, often overlooked, and need the support of each other. Sometimes there are things that you need to talk about and process around having a trans partner that you may not feel comfortable telling a friend or a family member who will just say, oh, I knew that wasn't gonna work out, right? I knew this wasn't a good relationship for you. When all you're trying to do is just say, I'm having a hard day today, or this is not easy right now, right? We have a computer lab, so people are able to access Facebook, email. Again, we're doing a lot of job seeking skill training around job search and application, resume writing. We have an AmeriCorps volunteer right now, so we're doing even that kind of really micro job development. And we worked with a local agency that provides interview clothing with vouchers, and they let us be a distributor for those vouchers. We are able to purchase bus passes at a way reduced rate because we serve people that are classified as indigent, so we're able to give people monthly bus passes, which is a huge, like a $30 resource, but we are able to acquire them for 10, so we're able to help people get to everything that they need to get to. I mean, we know that transportation, and in Albuquerque, you know, obviously it's not New York, we don't have the public transportation system in place that people can really, you know, easily get where they're going. So being able to use the buses at all and not have to pay for that out of pocket can be a big cofactor in being able to do health-related things or have a job at all. We're supporting some incarcerated community members now, and we're hoping to do more and more work around that. That is sort of a big looming thing in New Mexico, is trying to work with corrections and figure out how to improve that situation. We are in partnership with a newly formed group called Safe Sex Work, and we're really excited to be hosting them and actually serving as their fiscal sponsor to show a really close connection and partnership with them, so that our trans feminine folks who are engaged in commercial or survival sex know that that is something they can access. Because we know that trans people don't always feel that they're invited into something if it's just called, this is for sex workers, right? A lot of times as trans people we think, well, that doesn't mean me though. They mean cisgender sex workers, right? Not me. So we're really excited about that. Also, we're doing things right now like a pottery class at our place. And I got to go to the Trans Leadership Summit last fall, and I got to see a young man talk from Atlanta. And he talked about how so much of this stuff, and even the stuff I'm talking about tonight, is so survival-oriented. We're trying to help our people just survive out there. And he said, what about our people's dreams? What about their creativity? What about their gifts? Of course it's hard when you don't have a job, but does that mean that you don't make art? Does that mean that you don't have something that you dream about that's more than just, you know, not living on the street? So we're trying to make sure that we're incorporating that type of a philosophy into what we're doing. We're also providing education, not just for the cisgendered folks, about transgender people. We're trying to bring in interesting educational opportunities for our community members, like nonviolent communication or other sort of cultural competency education, like our local FetLife group, which is the kink or BDSM group, came in and did their, what they call, intro to the scene. So it's very much like our Transgender 101, but it's about BDSM and leather and kink practices, and it was really exciting. That's a community, in Albuquerque at least, that's very trans-welcoming, and so people can have more avenues toward community and acceptance as we partner and make sure that we're bringing people in to talk with our folks about what's out there and you know, different things that they may not be exposed to without our center. So, and lastly, we're just on the brink of becoming a practicum site with Highlands University in New Mexico. So we're going to bring on a social work graduate student as an intern in the summer, which will provide even more sort of hands-on case management for people that we're really excited about. We need all the help we can get on, you know, apartment location, job search, life skills, anything that can help people to improve their safety, but also their quality of life. So I'll wrap up with that, but I have cards, and I also brought a few of our takeaway cards. We don't really have a brochure, but it's like a postcard style thing that has information about us. So if anybody would like any of that, come and see me afterwards, and I'd love to get you a copy of those things. Thank you so much.
All right. So last, we have Anita Ruddix, who is the Director of Research and Education at Callum Lord here in New York, a community health center that primarily serves the LGBT communities and people living with HIV/AIDS. After completing her undergraduate medical education in the West Indies, Anita completed a residency and fellowship in internal medicine and infectious diseases at the University of Connecticut. Dr. Ruddick's current interests include studying the impact of transphobia and homophobia on access to HIV services. She is a principal investigator for the Transgender Data Project, a research study to evaluate health outcomes for people of transgender experience. She's also a consultant for the Pan-American Health Organization on HIV issues and health disparities related to sexual and gender minorities in the Caribbean.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to talk a little bit. I was asked to talk about informed consent model that we use at Callum Lloyd, and also to talk about the Transgender Data Project, which was actually funded by OSI. And I'll have just a few results to show you, like, really how important this work is and how very grateful we have been to get this funding. So, okay, so I think I've said I'll be talking about these. Can we, the next slide? So just a little bit about Callinode. I mean, I think most people here are from New York City. I mean, we're actually just up the street. We're a federally qualified health center, and we've been in existence for quite some time. And you can see we have over 80,000 patient visits a year, and we see, you know, a lot of clients, about, you know, over 15,000, 3,000 of whom are HIV infected, and about 1,700 clients who identify as transgender and gender nonconforming. We provide many different services, primary care, transgender health. The next slide. And, you know, I wanted just also to underscore what, you know, we've heard from all the other speakers about the numerous barriers to healthcare that trans folk experience, whether it's, you know, being ejected from the door, not even being able to access health services, to having maybe the wrong gender marker on your identity document and not being able to access services. So at Callinode, we have, next slide, we have, you know, we've tried to remove internal barriers. Of course, this doesn't do everything for, you know, people once they're on the outside, you know, all the structural issues that happen. So we, you know, we do staff training, we do ongoing trainings, we provide cross-sex hormones to our clients at reduced cost. We also have ongoing quality improvement that looks at our delivery of care. And we also have patient satisfaction surveys and also case management with a transgender care coordinator. I wanted to talk a little bit about informed consent, and kind of the next slide. This is just a simple diagram, because a few people have mentioned informed consent model, and I just wanted to really say what it is that we do. You know, a client can come in and requesting hormones, and, you know, we do the baseline medical assessment. If a person can provide informed consent and we have a list of questions, you know, we will go ahead and prescribe hormones as long as there are no, you know, medical contraindications. And, you know, we initiate hormones. Can I have the next slide? And I think that the difference is that in the old model, and I'll say the old WPATH model, Standards of Care 6 and before, you know, there were requirements. For example, real-life experience, there were minimum waiting times, requirements for mental health. And, you know, we took that away. Initially, when we had our first protocols, we did have in our informed consent, you know, a visit with a mental health practitioner, which was really kind of to give counseling, education, and to sign off. And then when we had our latest revision, we decided to take the mental health component out completely. Because, you know, many reasons, but I think the whole movement has been towards, you know, obviously removing transgenderism as a mental health diagnosis. If it's not, then why are you having a mental health component to your counseling and education? So, and anyway, when people went to see the mental health provider, all the questions they were asking were about medical outcomes. If I take hormones, you know, what is going to be the timeline of changes? What are the adverse effects I'm going to have? There was really nothing about, you know, mental health issues there. Now, of course, if someone needs to see a mental health practitioner for other reasons, that is available, but not solely for the purpose of giving hormones. Can I have the next slide? So, I mean, informed consent. The whole issue about informed consent is that you need to be informed, right? You need to be informed about health outcomes, but we know that there are so few data out there about long-term health outcomes, especially in the U.S., which is, you know, a population of great diversity. And so, you know, we had questions about the informed part. The good news about the informed consent model, of course, that it made hormone care part of primary care. It removed the necessity for an endocrinologist or the psychiatrist or mental health provider. It also resulted in lower costs for the client because there were fewer visits. This was also a model that we felt could be rolled out in places that had, you know, were resource limited. I mean, we've used the Callinode protocols in places as diverse as South Africa, in the Caribbean. We have, you know, we have clients in Jamaica. You know, J- Jamaica's not known for being so forward-thinking, but you know, we have clients who are on hormones there, and they were only able to do it because there were protocols that had been written that really said that you didn't need to go through, you know, 10 different steps. So these are the unanswered questions. So, you know, what are health priorities? Really, what are the long-term health consequences? So often I have clients who are asking me, you know, what about cancer? You know, what about cardiovascular disease? My friends tell me this. What can you tell me? And, you know, we really didn't have the answers. And this is why it was so very important to have our research project that actually looked at health outcomes of clients who had been engaged in healthcare at Callen-Lloyd over the last few decades. Can I have the next slide? So again, how does being transgender also impact on access to preventive health services? And what about gender nonconforming people? Because, you know, often people who aren't on hormones, for example, or who maybe haven't had gender-confirming surgeries are not included in the research when we're looking at transgender health outcomes. So we had a lot of questions about that as well. The next slide. So can I have the next slide? So the Transgender Data Project, which was funded by OSI, allowed us to do a retrospective cross-sectional study using data from our electronic health records. And, you know, we included anyone who was 18 and up, and we looked at people who were actively engaged in care over a two-year period. For the data extraction, we looked at many different variables. We looked at all the demographics, so you looked at age, ethnicity, gender identity, we looked at insurance. For health-related outcomes, I mean, we had many, and we had 95 variables for each person, and these are just a few of them. You know, whether someone had cardiovascular risk factors, you know, if they were overweight or obese, we looked at hypertension, hyperlipidemia. We looked at trans-specific, you know, healthcare. You know, is someone on hormones, not on hormones? Did they have top surgery, for example? Did they have bottom surgery? And then we looked at preventive health care, because we had the feeling that clients, even though they were engaged in care with us, that they weren't actually maybe getting other things done, like maybe pap tests or mammograms or colonoscopies or even HIV testing, for example. Can I have the next? This study was approved through an institutional review board. We de-identified the data, so you can't actually look at our database and figure out like who the client is. And we had a lot of restrictions in place, password protections, and so forth. So just to show you like what we found, I just have a few slides for our MTF clients. Or we had about 1,100 clients, and for FTM about 556, and there were 8 clients who had identified as intersex. It was quite difficult in our electronic health records sometimes to know, for example, the birth sex, you know, a sex assigned at birth, because the only way you could know that was if they had had a medical exam, for example, and that it was documented. So we had to do a lot of checks and rechecks to try and figure out, you know, cisgender people versus trans folk. Can I have the next slide? This is another slide I thought you might be interested in. We looked at HIV status, and the interesting thing is these numbers are very similar to what's been reported in the literature. So for our trans women, we had a HIV positivity rate of about 28%, and for our trans guys, it was about 1.7%. But I should also let you know that we didn't have 100% rate of HIV testing. If you hadn't been tested, you weren't included here. So you can see about 38% of our trans women and about 56% of our trans men had no documentation of an HIV test. But that's another part about screening behavior. And it would come under that. Can I have the next slide? And I also wanted to show you here as far as our HIV prevalence rates and race. I mean, you can see here there's a lot of you know, it's quite varied across racial and ethnic groups. So our African-American trans women had 47% HIV seropositivity, whereas other groups had lower. And again, this has also been reported in the literature. We looked at different types of screening rates, and I've already told you, like, you know, uptake of pap tests was low, uptake of bone density scans was low, mammography rates were low. I mean, I put here colon cancer screening rates because it's the one screening test that if you're over 50, everyone should get, right? And you can see here that even though overall for our clients, we had about 30% had had a colonoscopy within 10 years. It was fewer than 1 in 10 for transgender clients. So those numbers were really very, very low. And this was also after we adjusted for simple things that, you know, like whether or not you have insurance or what your education level was. So, you know, these were adjusted rates. Can I have the next? Some other health issues that we found. I already spoke about the lower rates of preventive health screenings. The other thing was that we had very high rates of overweight and obesity among our transgender women, and high rates of tobacco use, and also high rates of substance use overall. So I think that, you know, as far as next steps, what we're doing is comparing the rates of health outcomes that we've seen and risk factors that we've seen in our database, and comparing it to New York City as a whole, because there are surveys that we can compare to, and then we'll really have a good idea of what we need to intervene on. The next will obviously be the dissemination of results, and we will be preparing a report. And I think that targeted health promotion activities, you know, a lot of the research so far has really focused on HIV and STIs, and I think that we all know that health is much bigger than that. I mean, you know, I haven't even spoken about the mental health outcomes we've seen. I mean, as I said, we had 95 variables, so there's a lot of information here. But it's just so important to talk about access to primary health care. I mean, everyone has brought it up. I mean, you know, even before you can talk about HIV, you know, you have to talk about testing, right? I mean, people need to get tested. Folks need to get screened for cancer and cardiovascular disease. So I think that's everything. So. Great.
So we will open up for any comments or questions. So if there are people who do have particular questions or comments, do we have a... Yep. Yeah, sure, if you want to step up.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Lopez. I'm a resident here in New York City. It is amazing what you are doing in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We don't have that here in New York City. The closest that we have here in New York City is Housing Works. Kate Forenza runs a group that does some of those services. Every now and then gives out clothes, gives us a safe place that we can go to, feeds us two days a week. I'm working on a transgender magazine. I'm working on getting things in this city so that we can move in that direction. I'm homeless myself. Been homeless for a year and a half. Within 2 months, I'm actually securing regular housing. I've gone through a whole gamut of sleeping on the subway trains to sleeping on park benches. Homelessness is something that I do not think has been taken very seriously within our community. It really needs to be taken seriously, because when we talk about a 41% suicide rate, I am part of that. I tried to kill myself 3 times within that time that I've been homeless. You know, and I can understand why somebody that's homeless and knocking on every single door trying to get the help that they need, knows what help they need, and getting rejected. If you look at Housing Works website right now, I was actually featured, and the article that it says is having the quote that it says is having the door slammed on in her face over and over again. And that's the story of a year and a half that it took me to come off the streets. One question that I definitely do have for the people that are of medical, what are we doing to make sure that doctors across the board have the same information about hormones, are given the same information about hormones, because I just recently saw, I'm sorry, taking more time, Barbara Walters' episode on an 11-year-old transgender. The doctor there said in the episode that that the girl would not have testosterone if she were to take hormones at the age of 18. Totally false information that we're giving to the public. And that just tells me, and not only that, but me seeing different doctors that tell me different things. I had one doctor that told me that my voice was going to change. Your voice does not change from hormones. I had one doctor tell me that within a month I will see a big difference in my breast. That is not going to happen. So what are we doing to keep these doctors accountable that are distributing hormones, is my question.
So does any of the panelists want to respond to that? I'm looking more...
Looking at the doctor.
We're looking at any of the panelists.
I think that, you're quite correct. I mean, there was actually a publication a year ago that looked at training of medical providers on LGBT issues actually in general, and found that there were, an average of about 3 to 4 hours of training for the entire medical curriculum. And when you looked at transgender-related issues, maybe there was only 20 minutes. I mean, it was a very, very little. So I think you're starting off with the fact that people aren't getting trained in medical schools, nursing schools, in other health professional schools. And that has to change, and I think there is a movement towards that. Also in your postgraduate training. And also, when you're in practice, you learn from your peers. And I think that it's, in the past, it was never a priority. I think people kind of learned there was a lot of misinformation. I mean, the good news is that there are a lot of groups that are doing the training now from UCSF Center of Excellence is working on that. Fenway, Kalanoid has been working on that. We have to train providers within our own institutions also. I mean, no organization is perfect. So it is happening, but it's going to be really, really slow. I mean, the same thing happened with women's health. I mean, women's health was always on a backbench, 50 years ago, So I think things take time, but I see a rapid changes. I'd like to know where your funding comes from.
Yeah, exactly. Where is my funding coming from? That's what I'm talking about. we're trying to piece that together. I want to respond to you real quick too, Jennifer. First of all, thank you so much for being so brave and sharing that personal stuff. I know that's hard. And secondly, trans people, we know that we right now at this time in history are frequently the ones to teach the doctors. So when protocols are created, like the Center of Excellence for Transgender Health has a beautiful website that is primary care protocols for trans patients. So it's not just hormones, it's everything you would need to know about being the doctor of a trans person. And it's trans people who are taking that page into the doctor and being like, this is how you do it,
But there's also certain questions that need to be answered, such as, for instance, Callan Lord, I was a patient of yours. I know you know me personally. And there was a doctor there that told me that I could start on hormones, come off hormones, and have a child, get someone impregnated, and then go back on hormones. Well, now I'm being told differently, and then I'm being told that nobody really knows, therefore, even if you had a child, we don't know how the child's going to turn out. So it's kind of, it's information like that,
There's a lot of room for improvement.
Yeah.
It's happening. Mm-hmm. This is where we are in history right now, right?
Yeah.
When I do my presentations, I'm always saying that I feel like our trans movement is about 40 years behind the sort of broader lesbian, gay, civil rights movement, So this, even our terminology, even the way we are talking to each other, is in this sort of infant stage of a movement, So it's just, we march forward from here, Totally.
Thank you so much.
So our funding is coming right now. Our cornerstone funding is from our New Mexico Health Department, and it's, of course, for HIV prevention, which is, it's like a wonderful thing. It's so great. We couldn't be any more grateful. Our relationship with them is so fruitful and so positive, and it's a horrible, horrible comment on what's going on, that the main money that we have is trying to target HIV prevention for trans people. That's you can see what it means, right? The implication is right there on the surface. Then we really have some good relationships with our like local and regional foundations right now who are really actively trying to help us find money to do what we do. We have a broad community base also, although of course when you serve marginalized people, it's hard to raise money from the community, but we do in New Mexico because people are bought in and they want to be part of it, and it's amazing. But right now we've been in our space for a year, and we have such an amazing track record with what we've done in that year with next to nothing, that now is the time where we're trying to go out and pursue some of the more major national and international funders.
So, Lisa, I had the start of your presentation, you talked about the fact that in 2005, Gender Dynamics really was one of, if not the only, organisation in Africa working on gender identity issues and working with the trans community. And now there's three in South Africa. There's numerous across the continent in a very short period of time. What's the catalyst for that change? What do you think has sort of caused such a growth of the movement in such a period of time, short period of time?
I think. In Africa, we have also in the LGBT sector quite a big network. So people started, it was almost like a revolution. Trans people started making use of other spaces. Whenever there was a bigger meeting about the other topic, they start taking at least a whole session or have a side meeting. So I think that was one of the reasons. And then in 2009, but by that time there was already some other organizations, Gender Dynamics and SIPIT, which is an intersex organization in Uganda, had an exchange program. And the strategy we had there was that, let's say, for example, between the two funders that helped us with that, which was OSI and Arcus, we didn't, let's say we had space for, I think it was 15 people or 16. So we said, let's have 8 transgender activists that is already in the forefront of things and doing great work in their countries, and each one of them had to bring a new person that's new in their country and not known in the bigger spectrum of activism, so that we can start as fast as possible getting more people on board than the ones that is just always doing the work, because we were scared of something like burnout. And then, you know, if one person collapses in a certain country and carry everything in that country, you have to start back from square one. So I think there was an approach that we tried, and I think it helped. That was a program that then happened 2 years in a row. You know, it repeated, and I think just by that time, a lot of people also, out of their own drive, it is not as if it was only the work that we did. I think it was just at the right time, you know, that turning point when a lot of other things also happened, both in the continent and internationally, that things just started shifting quite a lot.
Bear with me, this may come out as 10 questions at once. My name is Keto. I think that I hold this distinction of being the first out person within the OSF network when I was an OSI employee for on and off for 10 years. I've since left, and as in my work as an artist, I'm trying to help provoke a cultural shift when it comes to how gender is perceived and structured. My question is about the movement itself. Like, you were just starting to touch on that. And you know, organizing for trans health rights is sort of under an umbrella of a larger movement for trans rights. I feel like I've been witnessing, just in my 5 years in the community in New York City, like this giant explosion of people coming out, identifying as transgender. It feels like everybody's trans these days. Like, it's growing and growing and growing. And the organizing is growing, and it's a really exciting time and place to be trans and be an organizer and understand that stuff. And I'm curious, from your perspectives, where do you see this movement going? Or, I know, right? Like, who can really tell? But, like, I'm curious about the next 5 years and the next 20 years. And, you know, being 44 years after Stonewall, seeing where the gay rights movement has taken us, and trans stuff being distinct within that. So I don't know where my question is in this, but I know that you all hold more experience and broader perspective globally, and I'm curious about that.
Before we have answers, if anyone else within the audience, because we do want this to be a participatory, and I know there are a number of people who are engaged in a range of different forms of activism, wants to also contribute to answering that question, please feel free to do so. But if anyone from the panel wants to answer that question.
Yeah, thank you for your question. It does feel like it's a really exciting time. Like, you know, even in the sort of boring language of politics or DC that I hear so often, like Joe Biden going out and saying, you know, trans issues are the rights issue of our time. And he said civil rights, I would say human rights. But this major point of focus where we're seeing a lot of activity and so much changing, I think, so quickly. And from the perspective of the health work, I think one of the reasons that there are a couple of reasons that the report really focuses on health. And one of those is because, you know, as trans people, we frequently need specific services. But also, just from the perspective of the health work that I do, I feel like it's one of the clearest ways that we show how discrimination hurts us. Because health really takes the issues that we encounter, the discrimination that we experience, it really brings it home to us, to some place where every one of us, some of us may not ever need to have a job, some of us may not go to school, some of us may have different family lives, but everybody has to deal with their health. When it comes down to it, everybody has to deal with how well they're able to move through the day and, you know, get through their lives. And so I really think that using the connection between human rights and health to say that a lack of human rights for trans people has physical consequences, and you can see it in our bodies. And so that, I would hope, at least from my perspective, over the next couple of years, a greater awareness of the power of health for having these kinds of conversations and documenting all of the ways in which the shit that we take in, if you'll excuse me, every day, is manifested in our daily lives and what we can do to push back against that.
Do you mind if... Sorry.
I think what will happen is that trans medicine will be part of mainstream medicine. I think we see that movement already occurring in this country. And we did a survey among Columbia University Medical Center, the four schools, public health, the dental school, the School of Medicine and Nursing. And the overwhelming majority of the students want more on LGBT health and trans health in their curriculum. And there's a lot of support from administration. So I think it really will become part of mainstream medicine, which is very good news.
I would say the other thing, you know, we talk a lot about the ways in which trans people are different, but ultimately there are so many ways in which we're the same. And particularly in the health field, I think there's an increasing understanding that there is no such thing as special trans medicine. It's all of the same things that are routinely provided to other people that for so many reasons are frequently not provided to us. But I think there's a greater understanding of where we need to be, particularly in a country like the United States with the insurance system that we have, that we're grounding this in a discussion of it's not about special anything. It's not about special rights. It's not about special health care. It's not about special magical rainbow ponies for every trans bisexual.
Aww.
That it's about, I know, right? Aww. It's about the ways in which we as a community, as a country, are taking care of each other and of our own. And the last thing that I would say is particularly around, I think, one of the places where maybe as a trans person I feel like I have some of the most to contribute maybe, is talking more broadly not just about the trans experience but about the experience of gender itself and all of the ways in which so many of us are marginalized on the basis of gender. Whether or not we're trans, whether or not we're women, whether or not we're LGB and we're told that we're not acting like a man should or a woman should. And so having trans people being able to bring that conversation to the forefront and really show in our experiences and in the conversations we're able to have how the gender system is screwing us and how we can change it.
I think also Africa or activism in Africa as a continent hold an interesting space. If you speak of sameness, also like duplication on other human rights type of models that was previously there, the overlapping or the sameness. So there's a little bit of that. There's obviously a growing access of global networks, you know, with social media, all that type of things that have one hand the impact, but on the other hand, in many countries in Africa, you know, it's one step forward, two steps sideways, because the political environment. And that creates for a space where there's a lot of creativity, thinking out of the box, doing things differently, not always exactly only on the models that's already there. Some of it is duplication and some of it is new. The activism in East Africa is quite radical. You know, we actually can learn a lot of what Ugandan activists are doing on a daily basis, just, you know, for being around. So I think if, you know, that saying of watch the space, I think in a few years there might be quite something interesting coming forward from different African countries and what can come out of, you know, we have to watch the space.
Follow-up question, like, are there, like, what are opportunities and limitations that you imagine in trying to coordinate all of these things that are happening locally into a more coordinated global effort? Is that even possible? Or are the needs so specific in each different country or region?
It's dynamic because obviously there's a lot of same needs. Many countries have the same type of issues or needs or problems or opportunities, and then different countries are unique depending what is their political environment, legal situations, and things like that. There's a huge amount of language barriers. South Africa, for example, have, however, you know, we are having 11 official languages with English as the business language, but many people don't necessarily speak so confidently English. But a country like Nigeria is having double that amount of languages. Maybe not all of them official, you know, so there's that type of things. And what I'm speaking here is my knowledge of Anglophone Africa. I were once in a weekend-long Lusophone workshop where there was people from Angola and Mozambique. So I can't even speak really what happened in West Africa, where it's Francophone, Northern Africa. I can't even say what happens there. Maybe there is great work out there, and surely there is. So language, I think, plays a huge role in a continent where there is so, so many languages. I mean, and after language, now you get culture. You know, there's so many other things in this mix, you know.
I think it's important for everyone to know that the United Nations is working on transgender issues, and I'm personally working with the United Nations on transgender issues, and the particular program that I'm working, that I'm helping with at the United Nations has to do with impoverished countries, which would be some, that would be in South Africa. So I think what we really need to do as a community is get our voice heard at the United Nations, where they're going after smaller countries, and being able to use the models that we have here in the United States and the things that we're doing, such as you're doing in New Mexico, such as what Kate's doing with Housing Works and other people are doing all around this city and all around this nation, to get to the United Nations and get heard at the United Nations.
And also as Americans to listen.
Which is our
right. That's right.
Yeah, my name is Justus Eisfeld. I'm co-director of Global Action for Trans Equality, and I totally agree with the question: how can we do this on around the world? How can we ensure that trans activists around the world know about each other? Are able to learn from each other, are able to meet each other, to exchange ideas, to get inspired by each other, to hear what else is going on in the world, and then to build global communities of activism. In our work, we try to support that as much as we can. Our organization is very young; we're only 3 years old. But getting activists in different parts of the world connected and supporting their activism and supporting them in building not just local communities, not just national communities, but also regional networks and regional networks that are connected amongst each other is a major thing in our work. as well as working with the World Health Organization on getting gender identity disorder removed from the list of personality disorders or mental diseases to altogether.
Hello, everyone. My name is Adrian Coleman, and I have a question for David and Callum, specifically about your plan to implement some of your recommendation at the international level. I think I've seen the World Health Organization specifically. And I'll just take a few seconds to introduce myself and the organization that I come from.
We can't hear you.
Take it all the way up.
My name is Adrian Coleman, and 2 weeks ago I started a new job with the Arcus Foundation here in New York. Arcus Foundation is a grant maker focused on two things, social justice, inclusive of sexual orientation, gender identity, and race. And the second is conservation and respect of the great apes. Within the social justice program, there's an international human rights program that I coordinate with a specific goal on supporting the transgender movement at the international level. So again, my question to David and Callum was about their plan to implement some of the recommendation at the international level, and specifically the World Health Organization. Thank you.
Well, all I can say is I'm the lucky one who gets to write down all of the opinions, and David and Heather get to do, and Adrian, you too, get to do some of that hard work of implementing it. But turning to David.
I mean, I think primarily the purpose of this report really was to hopefully start conversations amongst funders, amongst international agencies like the World Health Organization, to give more background information around some of the best practices and case studies that are happening, and to sort of open up the field, particularly for funders, around this is an area of a health and human rights issue where funders can and should be funding. Specifically around the World Health Organization, there's a lot of work that's been done around the ICD review process, ICD-11 review process that's taking place, and push towards depathologizing gender identity within the ICD process. So specifically, we've supported work being done by the WPATH, the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, and I know that Gates as well has been doing some work around working to try and advocacy both within the World Health Organization to try and get the final draft of the ICD to be as depathologized as possible. But then also there's the sort of long-term goal of when the World Health Assembly, being 194 member countries of the World Health Organization, have to come and vote on the final ICD draft in 2015. So there's sort of plans to, you know, not just OSF, but hopefully, I know there is another funder that's sort of heavily invested in providing support to civil society and other groups to ensure that they, you know, have resources to do that advocacy.
And I think really, as far as this report goes, this is really, if you will, a shot across the bow just about the importance of trans health. Because, for example, in the United States, it wasn't until 2009 that the words gender identity appeared in a federal law. And that's even only hate crimes, which polices communities rather than really helping trans people. But I digress. So this is really, I think, just the beginning of working with organizations like the World Health Organization, which has just within the last 2 years started including gender identity and expression, including trans issues and some of the considerations it's doing of gender issues more broadly. So really this is, we would hope, a very, very preliminary and stepping stone to much bigger work to come. But at the very least, showcasing not only some of the issues, because we know what some of the concerns around the experiences of trans people are, but showcasing some of the stuff that's happening already right now to try to change that.
So I actually had a follow-up question to Kellen. In addition to sort of, you know, the outcomes or things that can be taken away at, say, the for funders or for, you know, government and policymakers, for other people in the room who, you know, from different sectors and walks of life, and what are some of the the uses that you think can come from this report? What are some of the practical things that people can do after today in terms of using this report?
So ideally, I would like you all to look at this and see it as a mirror. See yourselves in the people to whom recommendations are made, and also see yourselves in the case studies of people who are already making change. So whether or not there's a recommendation in here with your name on it, I hope that the way that we as trans community members and allies and all of us in our various walks of life can be involved in changing the conversation around trans health from invisibility to noise, changing the conversation about trans health from trans people as victims to trans people as leaders. And so that would be my hope for all of you with this report is, again, look at it, see yourselves in the work that you're already doing, in the work that's described there, and see yourselves in those for whom these recommendations may be a possibility in your daily life, whether that's telling your story as a trans person, whether it's working with a government, whether it's working with a funder, whether it's as a medical provider, making sure that trans people are getting the care that they need to take action.
So we have, is there any other, if anyone else has sort of questions or comments, if they want to come up to the microphone?
Hello, thank you all. My name is Rai Young. My question is about something that Kellen actually started talking about this being about gender. I find it interesting that a lot of the surgeries that are depicted as luxurious and unnecessary for trans people are also done coercively to intersex people. They're considered so important that they can't even be done with any informed choice. So I'm often up late at night trying to understand how that happens in this system. I think a lot of times I go back to the medical world often being a historical place of fixing disabilities. And so I guess I'm curious about how you all see the intersex movement, the trans movement coming together and coming apart around health issues.
I was just going to say I've talked a lot, so if... I mean, I think it goes back to the discussion about bodily self-determination, because ultimately it's not about whether or not you... what specific services you need or what specific services you don't want but get. It's about ability to self-determine what it is that your body needs and your life needs. And I think that's where a lot of the intersection that I see with, for example, the reproductive justice movement here in the United States is where I'm most familiar with it, talking about it's not about any particular service or about any particular procedure. It's about the ability that each of us should have to determine what happens to our own bodies. And so I don't think that there's been as much discourse as I think there could be between trans activists and intersex activists. And I would not pretend to know why that is the case. But I think it's something that moving forward, I hope that the trans movement, that the discussion will be broad enough to encompass what happens to the bodies of intersex people, what happens to the bodies of trans people, what happens to the bodies of non-trans women, all of the ways in which our bodies are taken from us and the ways in which we need to take them back. But I don't know if there are other thoughts.
I think just a small piece that I can add on that is, you remembered I mentioned that Gender Dynamics had a partnership with SIPET, which is the intersex organization in Uganda. And it seems, especially hearing from what SIPET is reporting and saying in meetings, that it seems quite oftentimes that regarding advocacy, there's much more of an approach that people will hear if it is through, you know, like in many years ago in the 80s or so, when you say the door was opened actually through HIV, that's how other cipher sex or whatever type of workshops and research was being done. And it seems like it might be the case in Africa that there's, as if there's a more sympathetic ear. if it is with an intersex approach, what is the definite answer, and does that reflect back to, is it situated in things like patriarchy because we are correcting a body? So it's also important questions for us to ask, what is the meaning of that? On the one hand, activists and important work needs to get done, so you kind of like enter a door which is opened. But on the other hand, what is the impact of that? Again, is the intersex organization then advocating for rather assisting parents to make informed decisions and giving support to them? So it depends also, you can even use that open door, but what is your approach? So that is important questions, and I don't think we have an answer yet, but it seems like there might be a synergy, and quite an important one, how the two sectors can actually work much closer together.
Hi, my name is Vicky. I'm at the Open Society Foundations. I was particularly struck in the very opening of the report, where it told the story of a man who could not get adequate health care that had nothing to do with hormones or surgery, but just basic cancer treatment. And I hear a lot about knowledge gaps on the part of providers who can't provide competent and sensitive care, knowledge gaps on the part of the trans community. And I'm wondering, either from the New Mexico example or from the international example, whether there are any success stories that you have or any best practices for just building up a simple demand for those kinds of competency trainings. I mean, if you have the Speakers Bureau and you're actually going out there, how did you build this critical mass of doctors, of providers who actually say, yes, I want to do this? Maybe it becomes, I don't know, a continuing education credit the way they have for legal professionals. But I'm just wondering if you have any examples of that sort.
For us, it was this amazing thing. We started doing it and people started asking. And the more we did it, the more people asked. You know, we're finally getting into a situation where we are having more bandwidth to try to solicit our presentation to people. But in all this time, the hundreds of times we've done it have every single time been because somebody invited us and not because we said, please let us come and do it. So I don't know how to explain that. Looking back on it, being asked that question, it's a wonderful question, because how would you market something like that or try to at least make the information available that you're doing it and that this even exists? But for us, it seems like in New Mexico, a huge amount of it was just word of mouth, and the fact that from the very beginning, we knew we could not do it on our own, and we started partnering and building relationships and alliances and networks from the very first day that we had the idea of creating the resource center. So that seems to us to be the networking piece, and the alliance piece seems to be, I think, where the information got disseminated. And then, you know, I think, you know, you have to make sure that your presentation is high quality and that people respond to it, and that it reaches people, that it's affecting. And I think that's part of it too. People tell other people, they say, you know, we've had four of these types of trainings this year, but this one was incredible. It was the most amazing thing. Not only did I learn the most at that, I had fun and I enjoyed it and I was awake and attentive the whole time. And, you know, and that's what makes people want to come and ask us to keep coming. So, I mean, we need to probably try to codify how that happened or document it or something, but in some ways it feels like it was really organic and we're just really grateful.
And I think then in the case for Gender Dynamics, I'm just going to speak for this organization of Gender Dynamics and not on the whole continent. A lot of the answer in your question sits in that very beginning years, the first 2 years of Gender Dynamics, before we were funded or really had support. And one of the biggest things that made us to be so quickly visible was we had one of our founding board members who donated our website for free, and actually up until last year, so we're speaking of 7 years later, Gender Dynamics had a website that was for free, the service provision, the whole thing was for free. So basically within the first 3 months of starting up as an organization, we were visible. So it was a way of very quickly start networking then globally, regionally, and in the country. And we had quite a number of invites from universities throughout South Africa to come and make guest lectures or things like that. And again, the answer there goes back for me into those first 2 years. Me as an individual who started Gender Dynamics, and at that stage it was more of a one person doing things, and it was extremely important for me, maybe because I was so conscious that, but me, this cisgender white person who is not, you know, I cannot be the face, so as quick as possible, I always ensure to invite transgender people with. Even, I didn't care if it was whichever university, it was important to ensure that there was a bigger variety of people being part of this gender dynamics, even if we were not funded or whatever. So I think that helped very quickly to start creating this idea of there's more trans people, there's a bigger visibility, and that is things that helped. So there was not a marketing really, it was just a grassroots type of approach. I tried and it seemed it worked. That's all I can say.
And here in the United States, there are two things that I keep coming back to. One is sometimes curiosity works in our favor. Chaz Bono's on Dancing with the Stars. Janet Mock has fabulous hair. Editor of People.com. Marie Claire, no? Yes?
Yes, Janet.
Go find the article. The other thing is, I think, just the persistence of a lack of knowledge about trans people contributes to ignorance, which contributes to fear. That's not to deny that there's a lot of hatred specifically for trans people out there, informed hatred. But most often, I think what it is people simply don't know. And when they find out, they're like, oh, I didn't realize that was happening. I didn't realize that I was contributing to it. I didn't realize that I could do something about it. And I think that that is something that's starting to change.
I don't want to trivialize Robert Eade's story either, but I do think that the thing that I keep coming back to is where we are in history and the amount of progress we're making in very short amounts of time. You know, 5 years ago is like a different world in the trans communities and in the trans movement than today. And Robert Eads's horrible story took place now like 10 or more years ago. So it's, you know, I would like to think that it would be more difficult for that to happen when he approached 20 providers in his region, that now, if it happened today, one out of 20 would say, come on in for treatment. You know, I that makes still maybe 18, 17, 19 doctors who would say no, but even if there's one that says yes, then he would have gotten the treatment that he needed. And that story took place, you know, at a time in history where it was even more bleak, more dark than it is now. The advocacy wasn't happening at this rate. It's you know, it's increasing exponentially.
So I'm gonna ask, we're fast approaching 8 o'clock. Did anyone else have time for final quick comments or questions? If there's anyone else, please come up now, because otherwise...
Hold your peace.
Otherwise, yeah, we need to finish.
I think this is for Callum Lord. Could you speak about youth and informed consent, maybe something about street hormones and harm reduction and how it all connects to survival sex?
Right, okay. So I should start off by saying I don't work in the youth program, so I do take care of young adults. So, you know, Callan Lloyd, many years ago, when I first started about 5 years ago, had a very separate protocol for youth that really mandated a lot of, many sessions of mental health and, you know, created a lot of barriers. And I think, you know, faced with that as a young person, you know, you're going to choose another avenue. So a lot of folks were doing, you know, silicone, were doing street hormones, and were not being engaged in care. So I know that these were revised to eliminate also the required mental health component. It's not where it should be. I mean, you know, the fact is that if you're under 18 in this country, many times you'll need parental consent to have things done that are not sexual health, for example. And I think that's created some issues in our institution. But there are definitely other places, you know, in Boston, in San Francisco, the LA, Children's Hospital, there's heat. There are many places that have, that are providing hormones to youth. And to be honest, even though it's not on our website, there are young people who are getting hormones through Cal and Lord. It's just a very difficult issue because of the, you know, because of the age. And that so many of our kids are homeless or runaway youth, and you know, you're not ever gonna get parental consent, right? So, I mean, it's definitely on the, you know, it's there and it's critical. We're actually holding, we just got funding to hold a youth meeting to bring all the folks who are doing trans youth care together to actually sit down and come up with a plan that we can provide, you know, full care to these young people. So, and that's going to be happening a little later in the year.
So I'm just going to offer the panelists 30 seconds to maybe up to a minute, just to, if any final comments, not compulsory, but if you do have anything last comments that you'd like to share with the audience.
I was going to, did want to say something. There was a question before about cultural competency, and I just wanted to just give a, it'll be less than a minute. You know, I'm from the Caribbean, and the one thing that we found when we tried to roll out like cultural competency around LGBT issues, and we were constantly confronted by providers saying, you know, well, it's illegal, what they're doing is illegal, and it's illegal for me to provide healthcare to them. And that was their rationale for basically slamming the door in the faces of people who, I mean, it wasn't even like, you know, asking for hormones or asking for anything in particular that might have been, you know, related to, you know, trans-related care. It's just about, I'm here, I need an immunization, I broke my leg, you know, and they were kicked out. So, you know, we had to work very hard to get into healthcare settings. And, you know, there have been success stories. There aren't many, but, you know, don't forget that, you know, we're not all the U.S., that there are people who are really in need of care and in need of trained providers outside of the U.S. as well.
Adrian, did you? I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank everyone at OSF, Dave, Heather, Romina, who's here, everyone who made it possible for this report to happen, and particularly also all of the organizations who submitted case studies talking about the work that they're doing, all of the folks who are out there every single day making the change that we need to see in this world. And finally, I want to thank all of you for coming out tonight. We really appreciate it, and we are happy to talk with you afterwards. And thank you again for joining us tonight.
I just want to say thank you both for OSF and also for the people, some people I know, and then there's always new faces which I'm very glad that I could also meet. So thank you for that.
Arjun, did you?
No, I would just echo the thanks. We were really honored to be part of this in 2011, and again now this is such an exciting publication, and the symposium that led up to it was so inspiring and so life-changing to meet people who are around the world doing what we're doing. It's hard sometimes not to get your head down, you know, when you do something that's regional or statewide in your state. It's a lot of work. We're facing a lot of daunting issues, and you know, of course now it sounds like duh, you know, but I had no idea that there were people in South Africa doing anything like what we were doing, and to not just find out that was happening, but to meet those people and still now be friends with them and to be able to, you know, cross-pollinate it all is such an amazing gift that was given to us by OSF, and to be here tonight is also. Thank y'all so much.
Stage. I don't know about these.
Yeah. So I just very quickly want to thank you all for coming tonight. I want to thank the panelists, who I think did a fantastic job of sharing their knowledge and expertise and their stories. I just want to thank the LGBT Community Centre for providing this space tonight. Very quickly, I want to thank Kellen as the author of the report. He did a really tremendous job of putting what is a great report together. Both Sebastian and Eric from our communications team at OSF for their support in putting this all together as well. To Romina, who works as part of the Sexual Health and Rights Project, who has been an instrumental part of the not only tonight's event but the project from the start. It's been a two-year project, so thank you to her. And lastly, and she left us before, but Heather Doyle, who until very recently was the director of the Sexual Health and Rights Project, who really oversaw and, you know, was a large part of the conceptualisation around this project and has been very instrumental to it happening and the final report. So thanks to Heather in spirit. So there's a little bit of food left. We do sort of need to vacate fairly soon, but please grab something on the way out. And there are many reports, so feel free to grab as many as you would like. And obviously check back on the website if you haven't already for copies of the report. Thank you, everyone. Good night.